I actually lived in Baltimore for 7 years.
Get out of here. During what years were you there?
I was there from 1972 to 1979.
Okay, all right. All
and so I was before you were born, I believe.
Yes, but the sort of things I'm talking about in the book must have begun about that time.
Probably they did. And I lived in a community around the Inner Harbor that was a white working class community at the time. It was before the gentrification.
Right, right.
And it was one of the most segregated cities I think I've ever lived in.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. It is pretty incredible. I always tell people, you know, I didn't, you know, have a white person in my class until I was in high school and I was going to a magnet school. I didn't even have any white friends until I was in my 20s, you know, because, yeah, you know, and then, you know, after I left Baltimore, I went to D.C., you know, which is also pretty equally segregated. So, and that's one of the things, you know, coming up here to New York, you know, it really just exposed a whole new world to me.
Yeah, very, very true. Well, Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You grew up in West Baltimore in the 1980s, and you write early in your book, The Beautiful Struggle, that you were in an other country than the rest of America. So put us there. Tell us what West Baltimore was like back then.
Well, the thing is, I mean, even though I did say that, what I wanted people to know, you know, was that this is America, too. It's just an America that people don't think about. It's a place in which, and I think this is so true even today for a significant portion of young black youth, where the most ordinary things, you know, walking around the corner to get the paper, you know, trying to go see your girlfriend, trying to get to school, the specter of violence hangs over all of the smallest daily things. And just how that alters your perception of the world, how it changes you and makes you into something that's completely different than what people normally think about when they think about American childhood.
Yes, and you explore that quite beautifully, lyrically even, in your book. Tell us more about what did it look like? What did the neighborhood you lived in look like when you grew up?
Well, first of all, I want to correct something that's sort of getting out there that I've seen in a couple of reviews, and that is that I grew up poor. I certainly did not grow up poor. I went to school with a lot of kids who did grow up poor, and I know the difference. I, you know, never worried about the clothes on my back, the food, you know, having food to eat or anything like that. You know, most of the book takes place during a period in which I'm living in a community across the street from Baltimore's famous or infamous Mundon Mall. I lived in a brick row house with my mother and with my father. My father had 7 kids by 4 women, so I had 6 other brothers and sisters. And, you know, during different periods, I lived with different brothers and sisters. They were always there, you know, visiting and everything. It was a really, really big family. During the period of discovery, my older brother, Big Bill, who's a character in the book, is living with me, and my younger brother, Menelik, is also living with me. So it's us three, my 2 parents. And occasionally, you know, my sister's home from college or wherever. I think the thing about being black, though, is that despite not being poor, it's very tough to be African-American and live in an African-American community and not have some sort of acquaintance with poverty, you know, and not have some sort of familiarity with the things that, you know, sort of infect the quote-unquote underclass. What I mean to say by that is not, you know, so much the stuff seeps over, but you're going to, you know, you're going to go to school with people who are poor. You're going to have friends who are poor. You may have cousins who are poor. I mean, just as an example, you know, as I say, I grew up, you know, pretty well provided for. My two older sisters, and I always find this interesting, my two older sisters and Big Bill spent their early life in the projects with, you know, my father and their mother. You know, so these things sort of shift and, you know, and change, but we have so much proximity to those sorts of issues. And I think that's another thing that's different.
Well, you had a really unusual family in many ways. I mean, not maybe just that they were, or that your father and your mother were not as poor as the folks around them. They had jobs, and they also took education very seriously, which we'll talk about. But first, a little bit more. You say in the book that when now I knew Baltimore before the crack epidemic. When I was there, even though it was very segregated, I lived in a segregated community. I taught at Baltimore Community College, and I had students who worked at Bethlehem Steel and African American workers as well as white workers. They made a good living.
Mm-hmm.
You say when crack hit Baltimore, civilization fell.
Indeed.
So, give us the before and after.
Well, and you have to remember, I was probably about 10 or 11 when crack hit. So my memory of the before is not so much a memory as it is a sensibility. And it's also melded with the whole idea of just getting older and things changing, you know, and the sort of chaos that comes about from just becoming an adolescent. But, you know, my, you know, recollection to the extent that I have one, and, you know, the recollection of folks that I interviewed for the book is that they were just laws. I mean, it was just much more stable. You could go to the skating rink and you could go bowling and you could do things like this. And you didn't hear about people getting shot. I mean, there was always violence, but what crack brought was a sort of catastrophic violence. Not, you know, I got beat up, but I got killed. You know, because I stepped on somebody's suede pumas. I say in the book, you know, a misstep onto somebody's suede pumas and the GI begins. I mean, it was the sort of catastrophic violence that crack brought that was just shocking. It just completely altered the dynamic in Baltimore, and I think in cities around the country.
What did you say? A misstep on somebody's what?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a line in the book. A misstep onto suede pumas. Suede, you know, they're all these sort of little intricate phrases in the book that come from the era. And suede pumas were a shoe, you know, just normal Puma tennis shoes, and they had a line that were completely made out of suede. And they were very popular at the time. And if you stepped on, like the big thing back then, people would get shot for stepping on somebody's shoes. It was seen as, you know, great disrespect for whatever reason. And because they were suede, if you stepped on somebody's shoes, the footprint was easily seen. And so there will be all these stories about people stepping on somebody else's suede pumas by mistake and somebody shooting someone else. And I think, you know, a huge part of that is that these people, you know, you're young and you're a boy and you're going through all of the sort of, you know, hormonal and, you know, just sociological thing that boys go through about aggression and that sort of thing. And suddenly you have access to guns. You know, you have access to guns. You may not have the sort of family background to stabilize you and to steer you through that, and then suddenly there's a gun right there. And I think, you know, that just breeds trouble. It just breeds complete trouble.
Now, you mentioned respect. There's a part in your book where you say, we know what we are, that we walk like we're not long for this world, that this world has never longed for us.
Yes.
We are the walking lowest rung, and all that stands between us and the local zoo is respect.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Well, I was trying to get across that is this idea, and there's a much more profane passage that follows that goes before that. And what I was trying to say is, you know, on the news, you know, whenever you hear about, you know, people talking about black youth and these sort of respect killings and, you know, somebody got shot over respect, people look at these folks like they're crazy. They say, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. In fact, respect is what people lean on when they have nothing else. It's just true of everyone. It's, you know, down south, you know, sir, you have offended my honor. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, when you have nothing else, all you feel that is between you and just a complete animal is respect. You know what I mean? You're going to give me... Now, I'm not defending that, obviously. I mean, I certainly, you know, I have a young 7-year-old son. I certainly would not advise him to go shoot somebody because he was disrespected. But the point I'm trying to make in that is that this idea of respect being a huge thing, I think it comes when people's backs are against the wall and they have nothing else. I mean, just as an aside, I've noted, you know, as this campaign sort of draws to a close, a lot of the talk about Hillary has been, you know, Obama needs to make sure he respects Hillary. He should allow her to exit in a respectful fashion because there really is nothing else. If you're not going to win, there's only respect. You know, the 1-15 football team plays for, I guess the 1-14 football team, plays for respect because they have nothing else. And it's very similar with black youth. I mean, if you feel like you have nothing else to live for, you know, that's all you got when your back is to the wall.
And we're speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates. There again.
Let me that see. Is okay.
And yet it's spelt I.
It is. I know. That's why it's okay. I understand completely.
Okay. And we're speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. So now let's talk about your father, about your dad. He was a really unusual man, a member of the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
And an intellectual. Talk about the forces that made him who he was.
Well, my dad was a very smart child. He was an extremely intelligent child, learned to read at a very early age. And he was raised in an environment in which it's not so much that intelligence wasn't prized, but the social infrastructure was not there for people to know, I think, what to do with intelligent children. For instance, he talks in the book about how he had no concept that he could one day go on to college, like that that was what smart kids actually did. But he was a smart kid, grew up, you know, in extreme poverty in North and West Philadelphia, and went on entered the Army, went off to the Vietnam War, mostly because there really wasn't anything else. Again, I mean, college wasn't really something that he, you know, saw as a prospect for himself. Got radicalized in the Army, came out, was a member of the Black Panther Party for some period of time, became disillusioned with that at a point where a lot of people became disillusioned with it. And, you know, went back to something that he had always loved as a child and continued to love all his life, and that was books. He owned a bookstore for a little while. He eventually moved into publishing books, reprints, and moved into republishing books that were out of print, buying about African Americans. And that really is his business even to this day. My dad loved and loves books, and so that was just a huge influence on me. It was, one of the first sort of initial, how shall I say, it primed me to be a lover of words. I got that from him very much.
And he named you this very unusual name, Ta-Nehisi.
Tell
us what that's about.
Ta-Nehisi is a geographical reference, ancient Egyptian, for the Nubians who lived to the south of Egypt. And my dad was just particularly struck by that name, and he just loved it, and he gave it to me.
And the Nubians were the black Egyptians.
Yes. Or not quite, I guess not. Egyptians at certain points when they moved into Egypt, but literally, a kingdom in and of their own right.
And yet he gave you his love of books, and he was a tough taskmaster. Tell us about that, and why was he like that?
Well, my dad had five sons and two daughters. And, you know, fathers worry about their daughters, I think. But, you know, and my dad worried about his daughters. You know, and I know there's this sort of trope of, you know, the father toting the shotgun, you know, to keep boys away from his daughters. But I think my dad really, really worried about his sons. Because, again, the period in which we were coming up in was a period of great catastrophic violence. The catastrophe for women in that period was a teen pregnancy. But, you know, teen pregnancy, you know, as bad as it was, I'm not trying to in any way diminish teen pregnancy as a problem, but, you know, maybe you could go back to school still, it was going to cripple you, but maybe you could get a job. There were, you know, different things that you could do. The things that were happening to black boys were just fine. I mean, you go off to jail, and that is like a completely, you know, it just alters everything. You're going to have trouble getting employed when you get out. You're going to have trouble going back to school, getting financial aid. Or you might just get shot. You know what I mean? Like, you might literally end up dead. So I think those sorts of fears just pushed my father. I mean, it really, really pushed him to make sure he was really on the ball when it came to his kids. And so in some ways, strict is the wrong word to describe my father, because in many ways, we were quite liberated. I was allowed to hang out with whoever I wanted to. I didn't have any sort of curfew for, you know, when I could talk on the phone. My father never policed what I read or what I listened to. But what he did do was he made his force felt on things that he felt he should. So, for instance, we didn't celebrate any holidays. For quote-unquote conscious black people coming up during that period of time, the idea was that, oh, if you don't celebrate Christmas, you don't celebrate Kwanzaa. But we didn't even celebrate Kwanzaa.
And why was that?
Because my dad didn't see it as any more legitimate. He saw it as just a fake Christmas for people who, you know, couldn't deal with the fact that they weren't celebrating Christmas.
So were you not celebrating holidays because they were, examples of the dominant culture, or was it because holidays themselves were suspect?
No, because we definitely, talked on, Malcolm X's birthday, so it wasn't so much that. It was more that at their root, I mean, so you take Christmas, for example, and I go through this today because I have a young 7-year-old son, and I did not enjoy not celebrating Christmas. And so, you know, me and my spouse, we celebrate Christmas, but I swear I constantly go through this. I think what my dad was most annoyed, well, first of all, he wasn't a Christian, but even beyond that, the rank commercialism of it, I mean, just completely, put him off. I mean, Thanksgiving, this sort of, its roots, given, the relationship of this country with Native Americans, and even beyond that, just the complete gorging of oneself. You know, like calling that a holiday. I mean, I think, you know, it just stood in stark contrast to his values. And so he rejected it.
So he was part of he was really part of the counterculture, and part of that counterculture was also the Black Power movement, the Black Panthers. And yet it was something, I mean, he was part of the 60s generation.
He was, except he was a counterculture within the counterculture. You know, like, because like I said, I mean, for people like him, the standard thing was, I don't celebrate, at least for Black folks, I don't celebrate Christmas, I celebrate Kwanzaa. And he was like, no, I don't do that either. You know, so even, you know, he was not even a doctrinaire counterculture person. I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, he was in the Panther Party and ended up leaving, you know, because he didn't like what he saw. It wasn't so much that he, like, became a conservative or something like that. I mean, he still believed what he believed. But, you know, my dad is an iconoclast, you know. And so he pulls from a lot of different places, loves to debate, loves to, you know, argue and go back and forth, is always turning things over in his head. And so even as, you know, certainly as part of the counterculture, he, you know, there was nothing doctrinaire about him at all. You know, he just didn't, he didn't believe. More than anything, he treasured free thinking, has always treasured free thinking. I mean, me and him, we debate about the stuff I write, you know, to this day. We debated about the style in which the book was written, you know, and whether that was the, you know, the best way to proceed. And so I think what he wants, you know, what he wanted for us, more than that we agree with him, was that, you know, we be thinking individuals. You know, that I think was his highest aspiration for us.
And how was that for you? Now, you also had a family in which there was not just free thinking, but a certain amount of free loving, as you say. He had, you know, 7 kids by 4 different women.
Yes.
How was that aspect of his iconoclasm for you in growing up?
See, it didn't really strike me that way because most of that A happened before I was born. So, like, I wasn't around. Like, I knew it, but. You know, again, I'm coming of age in a community in which I would say the majority of my friends don't have fathers at all. So it wasn't like, you know, next door was the Waltons. You know, I mean, next door were people living with their grandmother, living with an aunt. You know, father comes around every 3 years or something like that. So, you know, I mean, from my perspective, I thought, you know, what we were doing was, you know, probably healthier than most of what I was seeing in the community.
And yet he did have a girlfriend live with you and your mother.
Oh, she did not live with us.
Oh, that's right.
She did not
that's
live right. with us. But yes, you do. Now you're giving away the book. That's the only reason why I wasn't saying
that. Oh, we don't have to do that.
No, you can do it. No, it's fine. It's fine. It's totally, I'm willing to. But yeah, he did. He did. And that's you know, a point of tension in the book. But even that, you know, I was raised in such a way that it was like, my dad is my dad. He's not my husband. My mom is my mom. She's not my wife. So, you know, whatever relationship they have between each other, whatever issues they have between each other, you know, like, that's not my issue. You know, my issue is dealing with them, you know, as parents. And that was how I always carried it. That was how I always thought about it.
And there was a lot of love, too. I mean, it sounds like you had some of the advantages of having multiple adults and half-siblings around.
I did. I constantly, and I think, again, if this is something that one thing that Black kids don't get enough of, and probably kids in general, you know, that it takes a village thing, as corny as it sounds. It's just true. It's just true. I mean, the more responsible, positive adults you can surround your child with who can, you know, impute expectations on your child, You know, tell him or her that, you know, you're expected to, you know, go out in the world and do beautiful things. That is a great thing for children to hear. And I had that from everywhere. It just came from all sorts of sources.
I'm speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. Now, your dad became a librarian at Howard University, where your older brother and sister also went to school there. And there, your parents' expectations of you were quite high academically. As you say, you got your love of words there, and you're a journalist now. But you had a kind of rocky, ambivalent relationship to school.
Yeah, Always had, always have, probably always will have. I wasn't very good at school. I was pretty smart. But I, you know, when it came down to sitting in a seat and listening to somebody for 40 minutes, and I just, my mind wasn't there. I was too easily distracted, still am too easily distracted. And I performed quite poorly. Somehow, my parents dragged me, across the finish line in the college. But, I've always performed quite poorly in school.
Do you have the book there?
In terms of why I performed poorly in school?
No, in terms of reading a little section.
Oh, do I have a book here?
Do you have a copy of your book?
Do I have a copy? I'm sure I have it somewhere. Can you hold on 1 second?
Yeah.
This is really bad, but I can't find one.
Oh, you can't. Okay.
Oh, no, here's one. Here's one right here.
Oh, good.
Okay, what did you want me to read?
Yeah, and it was about this. I found this actually quite moving, this section. And I'm going to have to bleep out one of the words, but it's okay. You can go ahead and say it, and I'll just bleep it out later.
Mm-hmm.
On page 169, you talk about kind of there's a sense of the adults around you who are watching you and worrying about your academic achievement here. You say they watch me. They knew that you were smart. They watched me absorb books about my own and further about foreign places and geographies. And yet, whenever someone threatened to put a grade on it, you say, I fell asleep and lost interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like you to read the next paragraph. And it goes from the bottom of 169 to the top of 170. And in this, you're talking about your older brother as well as yourself. And that's Big Bill, starts with, in this, Big Bill and I were one.
Oh, okay. All right. You ready?
Yeah.
In this, Big Bill and I were one. Our folks understood that there was a war upon us and that school was a weapon that outdid any Glock. Yet the whole process, with its equally spaced desks, precisely timed periods and lectures, with its standardized pencils and tests, felt unnatural to me. But much as I hated their terms, having been impressed into them, I hated more the failing. So I was left with great unconscious sadness and emptiness, which even when I was alone, I was not fully aware. But it worked on me like an invisible weight, altered my laughter, posture, my approach to girls. Forget what you have heard or what you have seen in your son. He may lie about homework and laugh when the teacher calls home. He may curse his teacher, propose arson for the whole public school system. But inside is the same sense that was in me. None of us ever want to fail. None of us ever want to be unworthy, to not measure up.
Yeah, that weight, that unconscious sadness. I wonder if that's something, that not only you experienced, but that you also saw not only in you and your big brother, Bill, but also in the boys around you, there's been a big debate, I think, in the African-American community and that, certainly been witnessed by, the rest of America around, do African-American kids care about school?
Yeah, I think that's poppycock. And, I think if you're a smart kid, right, and you're a young black kid and you're smart, you get teased. You get teased. Like all smart kids get teased, especially if you're smart and socially awkward, smart, socially awkward, which sometimes, goes hand in hand. You get teased. You get teased. And I got teased. But, like, that's sort of based on this mythical parallel world wherein white, smart, socially awkward kids are like class president and captain of the football team. In the real world, smart, socially awkward kids get teased. I didn't know anybody who, if you talk to them and they were like, are you happy you failed? They would say yes. I mean, I don't, people make decisions for all sorts of reasons. Wanting to fail, though, it's just sort of, we get to say things about black kids because usually there are no black kids around to talk for themselves. Or to be, interviewed, that, are just completely ludicrous. And that was one of the things I wanted to do in this book. no one, you know what I mean? Black kids don't, you know, want to fail. You know, that doesn't mean that, you know, schools should be made any easier for them. But if you begin with the presumption that they, you know, don't care about school, then, you know, there's really nothing else to talk about. You know, so it's just a way of shutting down the conversation. I mean, what else can you say? I mean, you know, because all that, you know, if you say, well, black boys don't care about school, that's why this is happening the way it is. Well, I mean, then, you know, what else is there? It's on them then. You know, and I find it preposterous to look at children, you know, and to draw those sorts of, you know, conclusions. It's deeply dehumanizing and flattening, and just sort of reflects, I think, a general frustration that adults may feel. But, you know, one of the things that I'm clear on is I remember being a kid, and I remember, you know, what I did, and I remember my motivations. And so I've decided that I'm going to carry that with me throughout my life when I decide to talk about children and when I'm speaking on how children are. I'm going to remember how I was as a child. And I know that I didn't like the fact. I did bad at school, and I failed quite a bit. But I didn't, you know, you could not say that I didn't care. I mean, it was the only thing I really had to draw my self-esteem from. And so it actually did great injury to do bad at school. So I hate that whole line of thinking.
So is there something there, then, about the difference in expectations? That is, that the society in some way expects black kids to fail, and then they do?
I think most black, not most, I think a significant number of black kids, first of all, I think most black kids, you know, if you just go across the board, have less access to wealth. So you begin there. And so parents are much more harried and thinking about other things. Okay, so you start there. Second, most black kids, or I'm sorry, again, I keep saying most. I'm falling into that trap of most. A significant,
yeah, and me too. I did too. So
yeah,
I want to correct
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's very easy to slip into it. A significant portion of black kids do not have fathers. They just don't. And, you know, you can go back and debate on the gender politics of this, but the fact of the matter is raising kids is an extremely difficult job. And so raising one with a single parent is hard enough. When you start getting into two, three, four, and there's really only one parent there on a day-to-day basis, you're going to have trouble. You're going to have trouble. And, you know, I'm, as you can, you know, see, quite progressive on some of this stuff. But, I mean, it's just, it's no getting away from the fact that it begins with parents. It really does. We have all of these debates about schools and, you know, what are schools doing and what do schools need to do more. And schools are left to deal with situations that arise from all of the time a kid spends, you know, away from school. And so how you, you know, address that and, you know, put school in isolation of everything else that's happening in a community, in a family, you know, I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, and yet in your book, I think there's, I think your book, The Beautiful Struggle, really explores in a very moving way how your family was able to do that. I mean, you had some gifts in your family, but you also had some tremendous struggles, and so it does also come down to some sense to the individual.
It does, and then there's the other thing, you know. I mean, for me, it's very structural. I know I had quite a bit of support, and I don't know where I would be had I, say, been adopted. But my dad comes from a completely different situation where he didn't have the level of family support I had. And so I just marvel at who he is. So, you know, yeah, some of that also comes down to, you know, put your foot on the gas and do it. You know, that definitely does play a role in that. But I don't want it simplified. You know, it's not one thing. It's about 50 things working at the same time. And the other thing that people have to remember is basically until the mid-1960s, African-Americans really weren't citizens of this country in full. And, you know, you're talking about a legacy of not, I mean, let's just put slavery aside. You're talking about Jim Crow. I mean, you're talking about covenant, you know, housing covenants. You're talking about housing discrimination. You're talking about redlining. That is basically, you know, a state-sponsored transfer of wealth out of the black community. And so we've been out of that for, you know, what do you say, maybe 30, 35 years, and we expect basically a century's worth of damage to be healed in 30, 35 years. You know, at a point when no one is really interested in healing that damage and, you know, hasn't really been for some time. It's going to, you know, and I'm an optimist. I'm not saying that to be pessimistic. You know, I think African-Americans have made great strides, but this is going to take time. It doesn't happen overnight.
And what about you and your work as a journalist? I mean, you've written a memoir here, and does your work as a journalist also address these concerns?
Yeah, I try really hard to. I just had a piece in The Atlantic on Bill Cosby, you know, looking at a lot of this and how African Americans were dealing with it.
What's your take on his position?
Tough question to answer. I wrote like 7,000 words. I think a lot of black people agree with him. I think that's the first thing that has to be said. I'm instantly suspicious of, you know, minimalizing problems down to if you just do this, everything will be okay. And that kind of goes across the board. I mean, I'm skeptical that if you simply funded schools better, everything would be okay. You know, I'm also skeptical that, you know, if black parents made their kids pull their jeans up, everything would be okay. I think there are a lot of factors at work, but I think what the most puzzling for me and the hardest, I think, to deal with it is not having two parents. Now, I know this is happening across the board in the country, and that must be said. You know, like within the context of America, this is what's, if there were no black people, we would still be facing this because it's happening across the country, you know, among white people and in other communities. But, you know, we can ill afford it. We're the people who can least afford for that to be the situation. And, you know, this is just my perspective. This is just me talking, you know, dealing with how I came up, minus a parent in the home, not having that other parent. I mean, and maybe not in the home, but not having another parent who was deeply involved in how I was being reared, I would have been in trouble. I would have been in serious, serious trouble.
And as you say, and as Hillary Clinton has said, it does take a village.
Yeah, because you really need more than two. I mean, you need two to be, you know, on them, and you know, to be applying constant pressure. And you know, I call it positive pressure in the sense of expectations and that sort of thing. See, even though I didn't do well in school, I was clear on what I wasn't to do. You know, I was very clear that I was not going to grow up and sell crack. That would be a complete disgrace of my parents. So even though there was much stress over what I was, you know, not living up to, there was great clarity over what I would not be. You know, I wasn't going to go to jail. Like, that just wasn't going to happen, you know, because there were too many people who I would have to face would be immensely disappointed. And I carried that weight with me into my 20s, you know, into my early 30s, probably even to some extent up till now. And, you know, as stressful as it was, it's good weight. Kids need to feel like people expect some things out of them.
And yet, your elder brother did fall into some of that.
He did, but I think the expectations pulled him back, too. You know, I think at the end of the day, you know, people, that stuff becomes part of your identity. So even when you're completely out there, you know, doing whatever you're doing, you know, if you have those, it's like, you know, your parents talk you to death when you're a kid about what you should do, what you need to do, da da. And then one day you leave their house, and there's this voice in the back of your head saying, you should be doing X, Y, and Z. You really shouldn't be doing this. And you're like, dang, I thought I was out the house. You know?
Yeah.
And so even with him, at his most extreme points in the book, there's something, you know, saying to him, wait, son, pull back. Pull back. What are you doing here? Is this in line with who you're supposed to be? Is this in line with the best of who you are? Is this how you were raised? Really? You know, and I think, you know, black kids need more of that. They need more of that voice in the back of their head.
And the book is The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. And this has just been a delight to talk with you, and it was a delight to read. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thanks so much.
You got it. Thank you.
All right. Take care then.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.